Hi, my name is Michael Creamer and welcome to the We Make It Work Corporate Real Estate Podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be talking to Stephen Day, who is Chief Procurement Officer at Kantar, about all things procurement, but also real estate, tech-driven changes in our industry and much, much more. Stephen, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Michael. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, my pleasure. I've always enjoyed chatting to you over the years, and maybe we can kick off by you describing a little bit what your role is at Kantar when we say Chief Procurement Officer.
Yeah, thank you. Kantar is a market research company. It was owned by WPP up until 2019, and then it was purchased by Bain Capital. So we've been owned by a PE firm, very notable one, for the past 4 years, going through quite a big transformation. You know, just in very quick words, you know, what does Kantar do? Three notable things. One is it gives sentiment about brands. Secondly, it gives insight about how people interact with brands from a procurement perspective. And then the third thing it does is it does audience measurement. So they're the kind of three things that Kantar is known for. And what do I do? Well, I run all of our global procurement activities. Like lots of businesses, we buy a lot of investment in technology. We have to buy real estate services to run our buildings and all those kind of things. And then there's also a lot of spend associated with the data that we need to buy that informs our business. I'm also responsible for our group property activity as well. So in a nutshell, that's what I do.
Right. So a lot of experience in property. And maybe if we just touch on that by way of talking about the business. So how would you describe what the business is looking for in terms of value? I mean, I'm assuming procurement is about value, but maybe you'll correct me. But also, how does the business see that?
I mean, procurement's, some people are big fans of procurement. You can imagine someone that's had most of his career in that function, I am. And some people treat it like an allergic reaction. And I think, like a lot of professions, you have, you know, some good procurement people that can see broader themes other than price. And then you have some of the folks that just very myopic and just kind of focus on the price. The truth is always lies in the middle. What's undoubtedly the case is that a lot of procurement functions these days are having to expand their remit beyond just savings, but also kind of risk management. So thinking about the type of suppliers you're doing business with, their ownership, their own integrity within their own supply chain, their own investment in terms of cyber and how they protect their businesses. That's becoming a very, very prominent theme. As is, you know, understanding scope three in your supply chain these days and understanding what is the carbon that your supply chain generates and, you know, what are those kind of risk mitigation strategies that you've got in unison with your suppliers to begin to start degrading the amount of carbon your supply chain puts into the economy. So, you know, I think the remit and the scope of what procurement gets into is expanding enormously. And I've been very fortunate to witness that through the duration of my career.
And that makes perfect sense. And we can circle back, I think, to sustainability, ESG. If we dig a little deeper, if you were talking to your business about real estate services, what would they say or what would they be thinking about? And what would you be thinking about as where the value can be created by an outsourcing?
Well, I think like a lot of people, I mean, we're all wrestling at the moment with how do we optimize our real estate? And if you remember, you know, the Barclays CEO, the first 2 weeks of COVID came out and said, goodness me, he said, if I knew it was working like this, I would question why on earth we ever need any corporate real estate and why we can't become completely virtual. Interesting perspective. Of course, he was the CEO of Barclays, no doubt living in a big palatial mansion, some part of London, very comfortable. And then you've got lots of other people thinking, well, yeah, but I'm living in a one bedroom flat where actually getting out into the office is actually quite important for me. So I think when you think about the value and how you optimize your corporate real estate, you've got to really look at both ends of the communities that you serve rather than just thinking you're taking direction from the CEO. Very difficult to do that, by the way, because who doesn't get their kind of orders from the CEO? But the truth is, I think if you're a responsible real estate professional, you're thinking about the community you serve rather than just the seniors. So that's the first point. So against the backdrop of that, I think we've gone from a place where, you know, everybody thought they'd get rid of all of their real estate. And you've got this kind of very mixed points of view going on these days. You know, you've got some people saying, go completely virtual. You've got other people that are saying, you know, we're going to go back to what we want and look how successful that is. I'm being very sarcastic there because it's not. If you look at the number of companies that are tying themselves up in knots with, dictates that people go into the offices and just look at the employee kind of virtual middle fingers they're giving their employers suit them. And I think the truth is we're in a bit of a middle. And I think the middle is a really interesting area to explore because, you know, what does the kind of future real estate model look like for corporates? And I think there'll be a lot of language around communities, a lot of words about collaboration, a lot of words about sustainability. And that's language that can help guide and direct how we're going to kind of reshape our real estate. So bring that to Kantar. You know, we started with a very big corporate real estate portfolio. We have, over the course of the past couple of years, been shrinking that quite significantly. So our real estate portfolio in size is reduced by about 30%. And Cushman's have been big supporters in that, I might add. There's a plug for you.
Thank you.
But at the same time, what we've also done is been quite purposeful in terms of investing in the new campuses and real estate facilities we do set up so that we are making it places where people do want to come, but perhaps not as frequently as may have been the case historically.
So if I just to sort of build on that in a way, I think I get all that. And you're right, it's exactly what's going on. We haven't settled down, so we don't know how much space everyone needs and how many people are going to come back to the office. And that's changing over time. And I think that the absolute pattern we see is it's changing month on month. So we haven't got to a status quo. So given that, I mean, if you're, you know, as a procurement person, are you therefore thinking about real estate in terms of who can bring me not solutions, because there isn't probably a solution, but can bring me the latest thinking or can show me that they understand this or that they have teams within them who can work with Kantar who would be able to help you fashion what you do? I mean, it seems to me we've got a whole new bunch of services that come out of what you've said.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's remarkable the number of people that have come out the gates, particularly in the early days. You know, some of the big consultancies that all had these kind of practices in terms of, you know, how companies like ours could reorientate our real estate portfolio. We stayed away from that and focused very much on the traditional practices such as Cushman's. And I'm glad we did that because I think in truth, as interesting as it is, all of these ideas, I think the way that ultimately you exploit and optimize your real estate portfolio, you need to do that with a subject matter expert and not somebody that has just built a practice off the back of their own real estate learnings. And why is that important? Well, you know, if I think about we're making quite a big well signposted move, I think, in the industry that we're moving from our traditional offices in Moore London Place in London Bridge and we're moving to Stamford Street down from Waterloo. Quite a big transaction for us. And we needed an awful lot of guidance and advice in managing that transaction. And, you know, some of it is, of course, you'd need an advisor based on the size of the transaction. Who wouldn't? But it's more than that. It's also thinking about the location, thinking about the audience, thinking about the communities that that location is going to give you access to, what it looks like in terms of talent attraction. And then beyond that, you know, how you want to configure the buildings in the way that I described earlier, that is going to speak to some degree, a reinvention of Kantar as being much more dynamic, digitally orientated, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I think there is, in my experience, a small number of companies around the world that have the global breadth to be able to meet the needs of Kantar. You know, we're in over 120 markets around the world. So, you know, the expertise that we need to dwell on is quite deep.
Yeah, and I think you make a couple of interesting points there, which maybe we can dig into. So you talk about the digital transformation orientation of Kantar. How do you see that translate into the real estate space? And by that, I mean, do you therefore demand real estate, whoever you work with in real estate, to have forward, you know, have the technology in place that helps you do what you're doing?
Yeah, well, it's quite an interesting question there. Let me answer it two ways. So firstly, you know, we work for Bain Capital. Ultimately, they're the owners of the company. You know, one of the key things that PE firms like is optionality. So, you know, one of the things that I've learned through my time here in Kantar is thinking through the real estate portfolio in a way that presents options associated with divestitures, carve-outs, carve-ins of businesses. That's quite interesting, and it's a learning for me, because oftentimes we're programmed to get the best deal, the most optimized from an economics perspective, sometimes with the longer leases, so you get the best investments, those kind of things. That's interesting, but you know, you can tie yourselves up in knots and not have kind of value flexibility, which is what the PE firms look like. So I'd say that's definitely one thing that I've learned in the time that I've been at Kantar, and that's certainly shaped how we think about the portfolio. I've forgotten the original question.
Well, I was asking you how you see technology in the real estate space, and you know, inevitably I'm going to say something about AI, so maybe we jump into that now.
Yeah,
I know you and I have talked about that before, but how do you see, as a procurement person, do you see that as an integral part of any offering, or is that a nice to have? How do you view it?
Well, I mean, look, so first and foremost, you know, people use digital as a proxy for a whole manner of kind of technology offerings and all those kind of things. I don't know about you, Michael, but I sometimes find it very difficult to really understand what they mean by digital, because it's a kind of poster child for a lot of things. If they mean at the very basics, well, now that you do room bookings remotely on an app, yeah, that's digital. I can understand that. So I think one of the problems with the phrase digital is it lacks sometimes clarity and definition about what you mean. In our business, we see digital as really allowing us to accelerate the time that we create the research to the time that we're able to share it with our clients. And, you know, the process of research is everything to do with collating data, validating data, cleansing data, and then presenting insights into clients. And, you know, depending on the size of the research and the scope and the geographical breadth, that can take many months. So a lot of this automation technology, a lot of this AI technology, perhaps presents the opportunity for us to accelerate what we do for our clients a lot quicker. And you can imagine, if you're a big brand around the world, one of the things that you increasingly need is a better drumbeat on what people think about your brands and your services and how they're responding to them. And if you're getting authenticated research from Kantar a lot quicker than historically has been the case, of course, everybody's going to want that. And that's going to be a big area of opportunity. So that's certainly an area that we continue to explore. And there's been a whole series of product announcements that we've made recently that point in that direction. So that's an obvious thing that we can take advantage of.
And do you think, is that reflected into property? Because obviously the property industry now is like everyone looking at AI and saying, okay, what can we do more efficiently or quicker? And I guess like everything, right? Like the internet, clients are going to go, you ought to be able to do this in 2 days, not a week, or a week, not a month, because of it, right? If you're left behind, is that a sort of I guess that's a negative in terms of speed I'm talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think, but we just need to hold, also have a sense of reality as well. I mean, if anybody's heard of the Gartner kind of cycle, you know, there's kind of with Dev.
The hype curve.
The hyper curve, and then it's the doom of despondency. begin to start taking advantage of what these opportunities present. So let's be realistic. What's going on at the moment is an increasingly amplified noise about what this technology can present. I think the use cases are lagging a little bit. I'm not quite sure whether we've seen real examples of that, but I have no doubt that that technology will lend itself well in the future. However, let's be realistic. You know, at the base mechanics of any kind of real estate transaction is a negotiation with the tenant using a company like you, C&W, with a landlord, which is normally backed by a fund. You know, is AI going to make the intricacies of that transaction move a lot quicker? I don't think so. You know, it's a negotiation. You know, I often say to people, negotiation is an art, not a science. There's lots of negotiations, programming, behavior, language that goes on to try and get the best deal before you get to the landing zone. Can you automate that? Can you get a robot to do that for you? Honestly, I don't think you can. I think it's a bit naive to think that, you know, there's going to be an app in 2 years' time that I will be able to lean on that is going to rely on a negotiation on my behalf to get me the best real estate. So I don't think that's going to work. Conversely, you know, I think we're all facing into the pressure of having to measure and codify carbon in our real estate. We're all facing into a plethora of reporting obligations that we're going to have to meet for very good reasons as well, by the way. So I think, you know, I can see AI and automation greatly aiding us there, because my biggest fear is that we're suddenly going to have to start ramping up enormous reporting and overhead investment to measure carbon, when in fact we should really be putting our muscle into thinking about how we are going to reduce our footprint. And again, that will be through collaboration and negotiation and industry forums. So look, I it's nuanced, you know. I can see great aids to productivity, but if anybody thinks suddenly it's going to magically reinvent the art of negotiation, then I'm not on that page at all.
Right, so both yours and my job are safe, at least for a while then, if we're both in the negotiation business. But you make a really interesting point, and maybe we can chat about that, because you talk about, you know, the carbon, and I guess it's the carrot and the stick. What you're talking about is the governmental stick, meaning you've got to report, make sure that you're doing what someone in a country has said is the bare minimum standard, you know. So if you tech EPC ratings in the UK changing over time, you've got to be able to report on that. But then there's the other side, which perhaps is more interesting, which is how do you see a company like Cantor focusing on obviously something that's not its core business, sustainability and ESG, but nevertheless completely understanding that it is as important as anything else it does in today's world?
Well, I mean, I think there's a number of ways of looking at that. Firstly, by the way, we have a very significant sustainability practice in Kantar. So we are advising some of the biggest brands in the world about how they think about their sustainability and marketing strategy. And there's a couple of ways to look at this. I mean, ultimately, we are privately owned. I think it's no secret that private equity firms look for some eventual exit. And, you know, what we've got to be smart about is thinking that in the event that maybe it's an IPO, that will be an equity story into an investment community that is increasingly only going to invest in businesses that have, you know, their ESG credentials and a strategy to begin to start running down their carbon emissions. So first and foremost, this is an important solidification of Kantar's value in the face of potential investors. The second thing is, of course, like every business, you know, our clients are expecting us to have those strategies in place as well. And you know, we've got to think about how we are going to reduce our real estate portfolio. But just to frame this for you, which is, I think, is interesting, we calculate that our total carbon footprint in our real estate is 13,800 tons of carbon a year. In our scope three, so our broader supply chain, it's 180,000 tons of carbon a year. So again, I think, you know, one also has to take a sense of perspective in terms of where we've got to put our investment dollars into to begin to getting to a strategy where we are carbon neutral. I think in terms of our real estate, we've just got to work more. We own very few buildings. Normally we're own one or two floors of a multi-tenanted building. I think the challenge is actually more on the landlords increasingly in terms of what they're going to do. And I think, again, you think about the landlord's business model, you know, normally they will look for, well, I don't need to tell you your business, Michael, but 10, 15 year lease agreements with an initial rent-free period, which they then put into the price of the deal. And they'll look to do very little to the building through the duration of that lease, maybe with a bit of kind of midterm gearing or something like that. And a bit of a refresh. And actually, I think their investment models are going to be increasingly called into question, because they're going to have to actually go into those lease terms and actually make periodic investments where historically that's never really needed to be the case.
I think you're absolutely right. I think the model has to be set to change, because they're going to have to do that, which is obviously the stick part, because of government regulation.
Yeah.
And regardless of whether you've got a tenant in the space or not, you're going to be forced to do that. Now, obviously, it varies by country, but that's definitely the direction of travel. Now, it's a really interesting point. So the whole landlord-tenant relationship will shift as a result of that, shorter leases and or the ability for landlords to do work to the building.
Yeah.
And potentially pass that through, because as an occupier, it's not that you don't expect to pay for it. If it's government, you're going to have to pay for it one way or another, as you say.
Absolutely.
The whole back to the negotiation, you know, I can see new negotiations where you're, where everyone is negotiating what happens when the landlord is forced to make changes based on government regulation and what can they pass through, which today we don't, well, yesterday we didn't have to worry about, today we're thinking about, and tomorrow we'll have to do.
Absolutely. And honestly, my sense is that through COVID, this topic took a bit of a, for obvious reasons, a bit of a backseat. But certainly since the beginning of this year, I see the whole topic accelerating. You know, we're increasingly getting investors asking all manner of additional questions about this, as are our clients, people that we do business with. So it's becoming a very active topic that, in my mind, is accelerating.
You know, maybe to sort of wrap up and talk about the changing nature of real estate, because I think there really is something interesting going on. But, you know, we spend most of our time now with clients such as Cantor talking about, okay, we've always talked about cost and that's important, but increasingly it's what you said. Clearly it's ESG sustainability. It's also, in simple terms, how much space and how do you get people to come into that space, right?
Yeah.
So it's a very different calculation. It's not about, it's not just about how good are you at negotiating a deal, right? And even as we've just said, you've got to negotiate a different type of deal now because of the other two. So, I mean, do you see as a procurement person, I imagine then there's a shift in emphasis as to what you're looking for when you buy. And this, it doesn't only apply to real estate, of course, it applies to many, many things that you buy. But do you see a shift in emphasis as to the way in which companies present to you about what they can and can't do for you?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's to some degree, these discussions are always very situational. You've heard me say already, you know, one of the things that we try and make sure we preserve in our negotiations is optionality, right? Because you never quite know what the shape of the portfolio is going to be, whether it's going to be divestitures or acquisitions. And by the way, just to take the Fifth Amendment on that, no one should infer that I'm signposting anything is happening in Kantar anytime soon. But that's just a reality of the way we have to think about things commercially. So flexibility is one. And then if it, understanding manifests itself into real estate, it becomes really tricky because at the beginning of this conversation, we're talking about just the changes in terms of, you know, the size of the buildings that you need and kind of repurposing the buildings to be more flexible, agile space. And, you know, it's very difficult to turn around to a landlord and say, we want a floor, we want to see how it goes, and we'd like some more flexibility to grow into the space that you might not have sold at a later date. And, of course, what landlord can afford to offer that level of flexibility? But I do think, you know, for those landlords that have a portfolio, one of the things they can begin to start doing is thinking about how they can provide opportunities and flexibilities, maybe by thinking about how they manage their space across their portfolio and how they can offer companies like Kantar more flexibility, maybe not necessarily in the same building, but within the demise of their overall estate portfolio. That's a really interesting area that could be explored more for sure.
And in a way, it gets easier if you have shorter leases, because obviously you've got more space coming up more often.
Yeah.
And tenants growing or shrinking and or needing to move to a different location.
I think the other thing that I'm very mindful of is that I think our employees and our colleagues are demanding more as well from the workplace. So, you know, we've had to be quite thoughtful in our new London office. We actually have more capacity than the old building, but less desk space. And, you know, you might be scratching your head thinking, well, how that's possible? Well, more breakout rooms, more coffee areas, more breakout areas, more informal accommodation type solutions and things like that. And people want to go to places now that have high energy, high vibe. I mean, I'll give you a classic example. Sorry to burn the calories on this, but when I went to the MLP building, you know, it was a very common thing in buildings that you've been in 15 years. If you look at the lights in the ceiling, it's, you're looking like a rainbow. You've got lights that have been there from the onset of the building, and you've got lights that have only just been replaced because they've just gone out. And of course, what the overall effect of that is to make the building feel really quite gloomy and not very energizing. You move to a new building, well, you know, you're blessed for the first 2 or 3 years because everything's bright and brand new and fresh and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, over time, you know, the same thing will happen at Vivo. And you say to the facilities guy, well, you know, we want to refresh the lights, and suddenly you got a horrible bill that nobody anticipated. But the point is, you know, light and energy are things that go in unison. And I think that facilities people, procurement people, property people have just got to sometimes got to think about just not stretching the cost and the economics so much that you can exhaust the energy and the joy that people coming into the building can get from a very lively workplace. So I think they're, you know, some of the challenges that we've got to think about.
Yeah, I think that's, again, a really interesting point. And we talk more and more now about having almost in the fit out budget, or you know, expecting, you know, going with sort of 80% of what you think will work and leaving 20% yeah. that you can rotate yeah. all the time and try new things.
Yeah.
You know, pre-COVID, very few people did that. Maybe the tech companies with all their money. But, you know, if you were, you know, a normal company, let's say, you didn't have budgets for splashing around for high energy, good vibe, to quote you. Whereas now I think that's almost gone to the top of the list in terms of smart way to procure space and think about fit out. Because as you say, we're now thinking about individual employees, groups of employees, rather than just the whole cohort being the same.
That's right. You know, so we're in a building called Vivo Stamford Street. Looks going to look amazing, I might add. And it's got a patio terrace area. And we're just thinking about how we can have events and things like that, which is really funny. You know, a procurement person talking about holding events for colleagues and employees, you'd be thinking, my goodness me, this guy's lost his mind. Aren't you meant to be focusing on saving money and squeezing every dollar of pound that you can? But I think what I've also recognised in my career is that, like I said at the beginning, there's some procurement people that do that very well. I think increasingly the asks of procurement and property people is a lot more broader than that. You know, be the custodians and champions of energy and spirit and fun and all those kind of things that go with a highly energised, high-performing organisation.
Oh, I think you're right. And those are the kind of the new skills that we need to see coming through in across the industry, right? And it's like a... not a bolt on, but you know, it's almost non-existent pre-COVID, except in a few businesses, and now is pretty much on everyone's mind, and is probably the most important thing, as you say. I mean, we're asked to take buildings with terraces so that people can plant pollinator gardens or keep bees, and you think, okay, and you know, how many building owners build with terraces? Not that many, because they were never needed, but that is now a major selling point for a landlord. Because, of course, it fits into the ESG part of the equation. And so, I mean, it's just, you know, you can't retrofit a building and stick on terraces typically. So there's some real challenges for the industry, not least what we do with our secondhand stock.
Well, timely. I mean, it's August the 1st. I don't know if you saw in the press today, but looks like London commercial property is in a bit of a mess at the moment. Because there is this flight to quality, and grade B, grade C build is going to need some real imagination about what happens to that building stock, because it's still got life available to it. But, you know, so interesting. It's whether it'll be repurposed into, for example, accommodation.
And the big thing that everyone now talks about is embedded carbon. So knocking it down and rebuilding is the worst thing you can do from a carbon point of view. I mean, you're always going to end up with more carbon in the new building, obviously, than the one that already exists. So it's not a simple thing. Stephen, you and I could talk about this all day, and we have in the past, but I think, look, really interesting conversation, really good to get your perspective from a procurement point of view, and great to hear that Cantor's really pushing things in terms of your next space in London and elsewhere in the world. So thanks very much for joining me, and we'll be talking soon.
Thanks very much, Michael.